Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics. This is the podcast for people who want to keep up with current affairs and news. I'm Julia Bell, and I won't spend too long talking about the podcast because I just really want to get into the bulk of this episode. Today, I had a conversation with my best friend, Natasha, who is half Afghan and who has family members stuck in Afghanistan amidst this ongoing humanitarian crisis. If you're a bit lost on the situation and you want to understand the backstory, how we got here, what's actually happening, what the UK's involvement is, I have done a fully encompassing episode covering all of that stuff in a very basic way. So you can listen to that before you listen to this, just to get you up to scratch so you can follow everything that's said here. But that is a much more kind of abstract side of this tragedy. It just runs through it in a linear way. What's happening here is I'm actually going to speak to someone who is desperately affected by this scenario on a personal level. She is trying to get a hold of her family and get them out. So her auntie is trapped in Afghanistan. And basically, Tash reached out a couple of days ago and said, look, can we do a podcast? I just want to share this story to as many people as I can. And I want to do everything I can to accommodate her in that. So that being said, if there is anyone listening to this who is able to offer support or solutions, I ask that you please reach out. I have put Natasha's Instagram in the episode description, along with a lot of other relevant links that are discussed throughout the episode. Like I said, she's my best friend, so we do talk about religion, global affairs, politics all the time. And I value the fact that Tash is always happy for me to do that, for me to ask her tough questions, and she's always very patient in answering those. She does so from the heart, and she never pulls me up on being a kind of ignorant moron. So the same goes in this episode. I asked her about Islam. I asked her about her take on the Taliban. I asked her about her wider thoughts on the crisis in Afghanistan and what she thinks the solutions are. And she kindly shared on all of it. She didn't just talk about her personal strife. She absolutely, you know, talked about the wider picture too, and really helped my understanding, at least. So I'm absolutely confident that this will be a worthwhile listen for you, tough though it will be. With that said, here is our conversation from earlier on today. Okay, you know, you're going to have a different perception of what's happening in Afghanistan compared to the rest of us. We're watching in complete horror, but you must feel that horrific personal connection.
Yeah.
Can you just talk me through the current situation, not just in Kabul, but your family aren't based there, are they?
No. So my family actually are based in Kandahar, which is not really that near Kabul, but also I have family in the northeast from, like, you know, of Afghanistan. So they're dotted all over Afghanistan at the moment, and it's actually a struggle to get to Kabul safely. So that's a really, you know, all the media has been focused on Kabul. That's been horrific, but it's also been quite scary to think that what about those people who can't get to Kabul?
So, and would they want to? Because it doesn't seem like Kabul is the place to be, but is actually that the best bet of getting out of the country altogether? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, so I've been in contact with my family out there. Well, my dad has specifically, and they actually have been beaten in Kabul by the Taliban, and they've been sent home. So they've been trying to speak to their family across Afghanistan, say, don't really come here, but this is the only way out. Also, if you don't have a visa or identification or a passport, what's the point? So they're now stuck in these different regions in Afghanistan thinking, how am I going to get out? And if Kabul's not safe, what am I going to do? A lot of people don't have identification in Afghanistan, especially women. So women don't have pictures on their ID. A lot of women don't have passports as well. So I think if you get there to Kabul airport and you might have a birth certificate, you might have a way of getting out of there. But again, that's also quite difficult to surface, especially for my family. I know a lot of them don't have any ID. They have the ID of their kids, which is great.
But a lot of your own family literally don't have any proof that they are who they say
they are. My aunt, for sure. Yeah, my aunt doesn't. But she's got the idea of her four young kids who are under seven.
And this is the thing, isn't it? You know, you read about the priorities of the UK government, the American government. It is to get
people out who have directly helped our efforts, worked for our organizations, propped up our forces,
yeah.
and translators, and these people who kind of been in collaboration with us. But if somebody doesn't even have ID, we have no idea who they are. Are your family falling into that camp? You know, it's almost impossible to justify getting them here.
I honestly am at like, I'm helpless. I feel so overwhelmed by the fact that I don't even know what route to try and get her out of there. So for context, my aunt is in the northeast of Afghanistan, and she married someone who was in the Afghan police force, but he was shot by the Taliban. So he's now dead. And she has 4 children under 7 years old. Her oldest daughter is 7 and her son is 3. Yeah, it is awful. And she hasn't got ID for herself, but she doesn't have a way of getting to Kabul. But her older brother, who worked for the American, I suppose, worked with the American government for 16 years, has managed to find a route out. So he most likely will be relocated to America with his 3 kids and his wife, fingers crossed. I'm just like, what do we do?
It's not just as simple as like, you know, your auntie's brother is technically one of the lucky ones if he's able to get out. But it's not as simple as, oh, let's just get your auntie and her 3 kids who've just lost their dad, who's shot by the Taliban. Let's just get them here to a country they've never been to before. What we're asking as a solution for these people's plight is to just completely leave the country they've always called home.
Yeah.
So even then it's conflicting. Like, that's probably the best case scenario to save their own lives, but it's absolutely terrifying all the same.
This is what I've been so conflicted over the past few days. I mean, this week has been horrendous, like very emotional, very heartbreaking. And I've been conflicted because my dad came here, you know, when Russia was in Afghanistan, basically. And he came to the UK and they put him in a detention center for 3 months because they didn't know what to do with him. He was in prison for 3 months, my dad, my poor dad, because he was, you know, seeking asylum. And I know how difficult it was for him. So I'm now thinking, if she comes here, also I did my dissertation on the integration of Afghan women migrants in the post 2001 period. And really the assimilation / integration process is awful. You know, there's lack of funding for language classes. They're often victims of domestic abuse because they're isolated in a country they don't know. So is there a route or a way of sure getting them here, but then when they get here, can we secure, you know, their safety or their sense of belonging?
Mm-hmm.
That is another challenge for me, because I'd love to guarantee my aunt and her 4 gorgeous kids safety.
She's got four kids. She's on her own, kids. And her husband's.
Yeah. It's a nightmare. It's literally a nightmare. And the focus has been Kabul, which, I mean, I'm glad the world is watching, because the world needs to watch the horror unfold. It's literally a humanitarian crisis right now, and I'm so, in a way, I'm glad there's media there to show what's happening, but we are not showing what has happened across Afghanistan. We can see the pictures of Taliban taking over region by region, like dominoes falling, right?
Yeah.
It just fell, the Taliban. So.
And this is the thing, if your auntie's from a kind of lesser known area, there isn't that accountability of the media and of lots of witnesses. You know, the Taliban put out this international message to say, we are a changed movement. And we are, you know, we're not going to focus on violence. Our goal is not to seek quote unquote revenge. And when they're in the walls of Kabul, they're even breaking that promise. And that's when it's on camera.
Yeah.
But one dreads to think what is happening in areas that don't have that coverage in places like where your auntie is.
I'm really glad you touched on this changed Taliban point as well. I mean, we were all hopeful, slightly hopeful, that this could be a true claim that Taliban had changed. Actually, they were going to, maybe they were in negotiations with Western powers before, saying, okay, in order for us to take over, we will you know, ensure that women and girls are safe, but also have access to education, because that's been the real focus of the last 20 years. And so, you know, this Change Taliban brought like an element of hope to all of us that, okay, there's less bloodshed. So is it true? And we've seen unfolding in the last few days, actually, that's not true. Taliban have not changed. And my father called me and he said, oh my gosh, maybe they've changed and maybe it'll be okay, because his family are in Kandahar. The next day he called me, and obviously we got news of my aunt and her husband, and he said, okay, that's not true then. And we're all scared and we're terrified, because they're using brute force.
I mean, you are a Muslim, and something that we've spoken about many times is the struggle that you have with this deep connection and love that you have for your religion versus the narrative of Islam that we all feel, you know, where it as a religion is vilified. And I think, you know, bodies like the Taliban really don't help.
Yeah, of course.
Obviously, the Taliban justifies the way they govern by saying, this is Sharia law, this is a law dictated by our interpretation of Islam. Can you offer some clarity on that? Is their interpretation of the Quran at all accurate? Is there anything in that? Or is it as if they're from another world?
Absolutely. Actually, this has been my whole identity since I was born. But mainly, you know, after 2001, I really was hit with the fact that I hate being Muslim and I hate being Afghan, because God, all we are portrayed as is as terrorists. And I didn't have that upbringing. I went to Saturday school, like Arabic school, basically, to learn more about my religion and my faith, because I was born in London. I'm, you know, a Londoner. So, I, you know, that cultural kind of nuances and hodgepodge of different cultures really was my childhood. And I went there and I learned so much about being a woman in Islam. I felt so empowered. I felt so strong, because they told me that Islam was a religion which provided equality between men and women. So when I was at school, I was like, you know, this is amazing. And also my parents, they're both Muslim, and my mom is really empowered, and she grew up in Malaysia, and they're predominantly Muslim there. So my whole life was just growing up being this strong Muslim woman.
Yeah, and if I'm able to be frank, those words, women and empowerment, are not often used in the same sentence as Islam.
Yeah.
When it comes to the narrative that we are all far too familiar with.
And it broke my heart. And in 2001, I've been trying to claw back that identity that I had when I was a child, because I've been trying to persuade people that Islam and terrorism are not synonymous, don't conflate them, but also Islam and Taliban are not synonymous with each other. So I mean, you've been on social media, there's so much out there right now, but I came across this brilliant thread by Aisha Noor, and I really resonated with it, because she's talking about Taliban and Islam. She said the Taliban claims that they guarantee women's rights under the limits of Islam. As a Muslim woman, I don't believe a word they say, but let me tell you about the guarantees Islam makes for women. You'll see why I don't believe the Taliban. She then goes on to talk about the rights over women's bodies. And the Quran declares inherent women against their will. So women should not be coerced into doing anything they don't want to do. I matter, what I say matters. Property and economic rights. Quran mandates that women receive inheritance they wholly own and still be provided for financially. But Taliban strips property ownership from women, and Afghan women have been kept unaware of their land rights and far from owning property. The first wife of the Prophet, Khadija, was a CEO, a business owner, and so Islam mandates that everything a woman earns is her own, and what her husband earns belongs equally to her. So it offers women financial independence. I mean, education rights. 1400 years ago, the Prophet declared education is incumbent on every Muslim male and female. So education isn't my right.
Wow. I mean, when you listen to that and then you look at the Taliban's historic treatment of women, these ideas of Islam, it's like they're from different planets. And I get that all religions are really diverse and people can interpret them in completely opposite ways. But I have seen you firsthand struggle with having to kind of justify your religion because of the fact that this narrative maybe overtakes what you know of it in a way. And then just talking about interpretations, can we touch on the topic of violence towards women, but actually more generally as well, to enforce laws? Again, like all these other ills, if you like, the Taliban uses the Quran to justify its acts, its violent acts. I suppose what I'm asking is, what do you make of that?
But we've also seen it across different regions in the world, and I'm not going to mention them, but we have also seen state violence, because state and religion have been conflated and they've been ruled by a religious state, and there's been violence coercing people into following their way of thinking. So it's not a new train of thought, and actually it's not just Islamic, but it's been, you know, there have been many states who've done this. I think what happened goes kind of previous to 2001, but it really, I mean, I don't want to make this a history lesson, but the Russians came to Afghanistan, and there were these militia group called the Mujahideen who fought against the Russians. Mujahideen was also funded by the US, and they were given, you know, ammunition, guns, etc., to fight the Soviets, because obviously the Soviets represented communism and the West was, you know, capitalist. So there's always been like politics power play within Afghanistan as a region. The Mujahideen were a pawn in this wider geopolitical narrative.
Yes.
And what had happened was, after the Russians had left, there was this vacuum of power where people didn't really know who was governing them. And Afghanistan has been long controlled by, you know, different interventions and military occupations. And because of that, there was some element of needing control over their nation. And the Taliban,
someone to fill that void.
Yeah, and Talibs mean like basically students, the students of Islam, right?
Taliban so means what, student.
Talib, the word Talib means student. So Taliban represented are called the students of Islam, right? So they are trying to,
I did not know that.
Yeah, and so they advocated for stricter crime and punishment, because at the time there was, in Afghanistan, there was no, let's say, quote unquote, governance or
law and order.
Law and order, exactly. So this is what happened. And we all know what happened. And then, you know, when Western intervention happened in 2001, it was wrapped up in somewhat, I'm going to say, colonial rhetoric, that we need to go and save the women and girls from the oppressive forces of Taliban. But actually what had happened was, it was Western intervention again, using military. So it wasn't necessarily focused on infrastructure or skills, or how are we going to actually build a nation up using their own people, but actually what we're going to do is impose our neoliberal vision of what governance looks like on them. And we know how that ended. We're here now.
So the narrative is very much, you know, the Taliban uses violence to create their version of law and order, but it's like, well, excuse me, literally everywhere that's happening, and it's not, and that's not exclusive to Islam. You know, you can look at other countries in the world now who use violence and are not anything to do with it. Okay, but it's just, I mean, that is the narrative that we are fed, is that organizations that are too closely connected to the religion of Islam end up going down a path that goes against what we stand for in the West, and that's not fair on an entire religion. I can imagine that completely messes with your identity.
Yeah, I've been overwhelmed, heartbroken, but really actually helpless, and it's wrapped up in trauma, because for me, I have this I'm gonna say, call it survivor's guilt, right? That I have been brought up in London and the UK, where I've been given education, and I have utilized that like no tomorrow. Like, I've really, really tried to make sure that I've learned as much as I can. But what it's been wrapped up in has been learning about who am I, like my identity. And that's been, am I an Afghan woman? Can I say I'm an Afghan woman if I haven't been born in Afghanistan? And it's really hard seeing these images of women who haven't had the same, like, what lottery ticket, I've seen that posted on social media, you know, a lottery ticket of life. That I have, isn't my duty to being, you know, Afghan, to help them have a life that I do, it also feels somewhat Western to think that as well. So it's just, it's really challenging.
What do you think of the fact that a fair few civilians that have been interviewed by reporters who are brave enough to go out there have said they are glad that the Taliban is back? Mm. You know, this democracy was a fucking sham. You know, the government was completely corrupt. They had no representation. They didn't feel protected. The police didn't do anything. You know, there's stories of people who have been desperately trying to take issues to court, you know, land issues or whatever. And then when they get to the court, the judges are saying, well, I'm not doing it unless you've got something to bribe me with, that kind of thing. Yeah. And these people are saying, well, at least the Taliban, even though they're completely brutal, they have a presence, and at least I can feel that there's some sort of law and order. What do you think about that?
It takes me back to even what I said at the start of that vacuum of power, right? After the Russians left, everyone was really excited to have someone govern them. There was law and order. So actually, is it just history repeating itself and people being like, we have our own people governing us? Maybe without Western influence, maybe this will be the best way forward. And even my dad, to be honest, me and him, we had a discussion. We were like, maybe they have changed. Maybe they're new Taliban and they actually are going to make Afghanistan better. And, you know, there won't be violence and it's going to be structured and governed well. And I don't know. We can't see how it's going to unfold. Right now, it doesn't look great.
No.
But I can definitely understand why people in Afghanistan were glad to see their own people govern them. Right,
which is
rather than an imposition. I watched
that and I can't help, I mean, it was a horrific thing to say, but I can't help but have that white savior syndrome completely flood me, because I watch it and I think, how on earth are you in such dire straits that you're glad this is you must be in such a bad situation that this is relief to you?
Yeah,
that's all I feel.
And this is even scarier because it's like, okay, so now what are we going to send more troops in there to sort out the situation? Like, what actually gets better from here? So we can't evacuate like 40 million people from Afghanistan.
Is that the population of Afghanistan, 40 million?
I mean, about 38, something like that, you know. We can't do that. So what's going to happen now? Are we going to send in more troops to sort it out? Have we not learned from the 20 years of occupation and intervention? I literally have no idea what's next.
I mean, Boris Johnson said in the Commons yesterday, we're recording this on the Thursday, the 19th of August. So on Wednesday, the 18th, obviously, he recalled MPs to Parliament and he was asked that direct question, what we're doing about military. And he said, no, we're definitely not sending troops back. So I think we can rule that out for the time being. But like you said, this seems very cyclical. Will it, in another 5 years, will we sort of inevitably have to interfere because this gets out of hand? And of course, the point again might be wrapped up in, we've got to help the civilians, but actually, is it because the Taliban are in control and the Taliban are known for hosting terrorist activity, if not implementing it themselves? So that would probably be the real reason that we'd end up going back. You're right. And I think as far as you're sitting, priority number absolute one is to get your direct family, your blood, the safety, be that here, be that across the border somewhere else. So what, this is a horrible question, what are you doing?
So amazing question, to be honest. And I, you know, as a person, I do go straight to problem solving. I'm really emotional. I'm really, really emotional. And I know that emotion fuels me, but I went straight into problem solving, going, right, participatory politics can help us. If we mobilize enough people to support our cause, we can make change. And I still believe that. So I wrote to my MP saying, can I have a phone call? How best can I navigate the situation? I didn't get any response. I've sent her 3 emails and a number of tweets. But other people, so I wrote a template for other people to actually share with their MP, to lobby them, basically, to talk about it in the Commons and actually address, how do we get people out of Afghanistan who don't have identification? How do we grant them asylum? Like, how do we ensure that their safety needs are met? And I also explained the story of my aunt. And many, many, many people have got response from the MP who have shared deep concerns about this. And I think right now the focus is getting them out of there. There's a number of grassroots organizations that need funding, which I can share later with you, Jules.
I'll put them in the episode description.
Yeah, but I think right now we need to be lobbying our MPs. We need to be pushing forward with what we want. And I have got a template. You can use mine to push our government to doing actual change to help people who want to get out of Afghanistan to get out. Especially for, like, this is very deeply personal to me, but I have no idea how I'm going to get my aunt out. If they could give us information around the process of helping, you know, my aunt or other women like her or other men like in that situation, I really appreciate it, because I have felt very overwhelmed. I have even started looking at adoption processes for myself, because the number of Afghan orphans that are going to be, I mean, number of
displaced.
Afghan orphans.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I've already spoken to my partner about it, and we are. We're already. No, I'm not kidding you. Like, this is, I've got a huge document put together about, like, what can I do to help? I'm like, yeah. So lobby your local MP, fundraise, or help, just give some money to some grassroots organizations. There are loads, you know, more pressure we put on collectively, we can make some change. And I really believe that, even though we're a tiny voice, we can, I suppose, we can be a collective voice of change. So let's try that. But also, I want to maybe slightly pitch this, but my dad left Afghanistan, you know, when the Russians invaded, and he came to the UK, like I mentioned, and was put in a detention center for 3 months. But after that, you know, he stayed here. Now I'm here. We're going to do a kind of Instagram live where I'll be talking to him about the history of Afghanistan, his experience of leaving, and his method of integrating into British society. And I think it might be helpful for those who don't have an understanding of Afghanistan, who just feel a bit helpless in where to go to learn more. But this is a very personal story. So if you do want to join, I'll try and put that in my Instagram, you know, page, and I'll let you know when it is. And
keep it up so if someone listens to this later. Yeah, and I think that is really important. And I don't want to sound reductive here, but sometimes when you see so much horror, you stop seeing people as humans, because they can't. It's impossible to conceive being in that position. It's impossible to imagine being that desperate. So you know, people call it poverty porn, which is such a disgusting term, but there's a reason that it's got that term. It's because, you know, you sort of get washed with so much of it that you can't accept it anymore. And I think a really cool kind of progressive way to address that is to just get Afghans in the spotlight. Let's actually talk to Afghan people so that we're continuously reminded of the fact that this is a real country. These are real people who are this actually desperate, because you can forget, I think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, I know I have a small voice, but, like, for example, you know, you have welcomed me on here to talk about this, and I am so grateful. And now we can amplify this story, but also amplify my voice, because I'm a British Afghan, but my dad is fully from Kandahar, and his story is amazing. Mm-hmm. The amount of loss and pain he's had in his life has definitely been, it's traumatic. But if we don't hear from someone who actually has experienced it, like you said, it washes over you and you just think, I don't want to engage with this. And I think one final thing I want to say is, I haven't been doing this, but please, people, look after your mental health. It is horrific seeing this, and I know we're really helpless, but try and take some time out for yourself and look after yourself, because I have definitely suffered this week. And if it's, you know, anything, my friends have been telling me to look after myself. I feel guilty for even smiling or laughing or doing an activity where I am free
and indulging.
You know?
Yeah.
I feel awful. So
I know. I remember the other day you were like, "Oh, I've got an anniversary dinner," and I was like, "That sounds nice." And you're like, "I know," and I'm so guilty. And I was like, "Yeah, Tash, come on."
So that's my final thing. You know, like, lobby your MP. Fund grassroots organizations, listen to me and my dad, but also look after yourself, because you can't help anyone if you haven't helped yourself, you know. So,
and yeah. Do we have, just to finish off, I really was just desperate to get your auntie here. That's what I'm thinking about. She's in the northeast of Afghanistan. We can't necessarily share her name. You're not sharing a name, are you? You're kind of being careful about that.
No, I'm being really careful.
But when people are messaging their MP, you have a template, don't you, that they can use that explains your precise story. So I think people listening to this will also want to get your auntie out of there. How do we get people out who aren't in Kabul? Do we have something in place to create safe routes for them?
I don't have the answers, and I am pleading with anyone who may have the answers. I have been inundated with loads of emails saying, how can I help? And this is how you could help me. If we can understand the answers to those questions, we can move forward with my aunt's case.
Yeah. And then I suppose long-term, the point is, and then I'll let you go because I know you got a meeting at two, but long-term, I suppose the point is, you know, we get people out who are desperate to leave, as many as we can, and we encourage other states to do the same. And then long term, the situation is we've got to try and, this is partly our problem as well, we created a lot of this mess, so we have an accountability to Afghan citizens to not allow them to be governed by a body that does not care about their human rights. And I don't know how we do that, whether it's trying to negotiate with the Taliban, which sounds ridiculous, or whether it's trying to replace them again but not implement our ideals. I don't know what it is, but that's something we've all got to think about as well.
I mean, I'm also, if anyone wants to read it, I'll make my master's dissertation publicly available. It actually speaks to UK policy of how we can integrate other basically migrants into UK better. And I specifically interviewed a ton of Afghan women migrants in the post 2001 period. And I have some recommendations on how we could better help them feel like there's some sense of belonging. So just,
Because that is, you're right, another long-term issue. We've got to make these people who we've brought here, probably never been anywhere like it, got to make them welcome.
Yeah, and feel a sense of belonging.
And a functioning member of society,
Yeah.
I love you. I'm sorry.
I love you too. No, thank you. You're amazing for doing this, and I really appreciate it.
Of course, anytime. If you want to do another one as well, just let me know. We'll keep up with things.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, that was my conversation with Natasha. The links for everything we mentioned, the grassroots organisations, if you want to support, they're in the episode description, along with a link to her dissertation, which I really recommend that you read. And then, of course, her Instagram. If you have ideas or solutions or contacts, please, we beg that you reach out. I would maybe not clog up her inbox if you don't kind of have something directly useful. I know that sounds really brutal of me to say, but I would ask that if you have actual solutions, please do reach out. I'm sure she would be so happy to hear from you. Listen, thank you so much for listening to this episode, and thank you to Tash for sharing your story. You know, just generally to you guys, I hope you understand. I've said this a few times now, but I'm gonna stick to it. I need to take a bit of a break from the podcast just for a short time, just to recover a little bit mentally, physically, emotionally, from quite a hectic year. It's been non-stop, and as you'll know, I do this podcast all on my own, and I'm knackered. I need to just stop. So I've got to look after number one just for a short time, and I really appreciate your patience in advance on that. So I know I usually say get in touch with questions. I'm going to ask that you don't. please no questions for a short time. I just need a break, but I'll be back in a few weeks. I'm not sure when. I will give you an update on social media. Follow me at @JuliaBell_X. And the big thing, of course, is that I will not be going away from Patreon. I will still be uploading on there regularly. So if you want to support me, if this podcast is useful to you, if it's helpful for you, please join the community. It costs less than a coffee, and it is the only way that I can keep this podcast going. So if you've been mulling it over for some time, I'm going to ask you, please do it now, because then you get bonus content when I'm not making the podcast, and that's a nice thing. All right, I'll speak to you in the next one, whenever that may be. I don't know, and I don't care.
to be honest, at this point, I can't even think about it. I'm just going to go and not think about politics for a short amount of time. You should do the same thing. You should look after your head. If no one's telling you to do that, I'm telling you to do it now. Look after your bubble. You can't keep functioning if you don't look after yourselves. And it's ridiculous that society somehow expects us to just burn out. I'm refusing, and so should you. We're in this together. I love you. Take care. Goodbye.